Disc 8.
The truth is that faith and belief are non-issues for me. In a very loose sense, I suppose you could say I believe indiscriminately. Ghosts, bleeding statues, alien abductions, cattle mutilations, crop circles, prophecy, demonic possession, whatever. I let all that stuff in practically unfiltered, because it's more fun that way, and because I have no reason not to. I mean, if you view dualistic reality as a dream, which I do, no discrimination is really called for. Where do you draw the line in a dream? It's all good. Nothing of importance to me hinges on how I view such things, so I just view them. So you're going to try to completely tap dance around the question? She asks with a twinkle of amusement. Yeah, well, I was kind of hoping, I reply with schoolboy charm. Well, toughen up, mister, she says through gritted teeth. I'm a hardcore journalist, and I want straight answers. We both laugh, but as I watch her, it becomes more apparent that she's not as together as she was the last time we spoke. She seems to be jittery. She's obviously not well rested. But it's more than that. She's slightly frazzled. She's doing well with it and handling the interview nicely. But it's there, just beneath the surface. She's on the edge of something. But of what? Well, the real answer is that I no longer possess belief or faith in the way you mean. The question simply doesn't apply. Like if I asked you if you prefer antler wax or antler cream. I might say that I don't believe in belief, but that's a little cutesy, albeit accurate. I think of belief and faith as being ways of dealing with things you can't know for sure, and I am not involved in not knowing for sure. Homie, don't play that. I don't have any gaps I need filled. I should point out that this isn't peculiar to me. This would be the stock response you'd get from anyone in my situation. By situation, you mean fully enlightened? Well, there's no partial enlightenment. But yeah, anyone who knows what I know would say the same thing. Belief and faith aren't factors in enlightenment. I mean, I have beliefs, I suppose, as anyone must. That's why the answer isn't a simple yes or no. I have beliefs regarding personal reality and the afterlife and whatever else we can't see within the dream, so that we have to use imagination and intelligence to tell us what's there. But none of that has any bearing whatsoever on enlightenment. I'm rambling now. That's what I do when I try to answer questions I shouldn't mess with, questions that don't really translate well. Don't translate how? From an unenlightened person to an enlightened one? And back again. Yes, kind of. Enlightenment is comprehensive. It's an entirely different paradigm. My reality is not your reality. All the rules are different. It's like I speak a different language altogether. And the reason we can communicate at all is because I used to speak your language, and I remember a little of it. Less every day, it seems. Is that getting across at all? I'm not saying it well. Actually, she reassures me, it's very interesting. So, if another enlightened person were here right now, you and he could understand each other perfectly well? Damn. I'm watching an analogy meltdown. Yes, sort of, theoretically. He and I could speak the same tongue. But it wouldn't happen. There wouldn't be anything to say. I played both sides of a mock conversation to illustrate. It'd be like, hi, how's it going? Good, thanks. How about you? Oh, yeah, fine. How's the enlightenment thing working out for you? Oh, real good, thanks. Really getting a kick out of it. You? Oh, same, yeah, real pleased. She's giggling now, amused by my little performance. There's just nothing to say. Caterpillars may talk to each other, but butterflies don't. It's like, you know how vampires are? Oh, vampires again, she says. No, I don't know any personally. Well, the thing about vampires is you never see them hanging out together. That's because they don't really bond well. They don't desire each other's company or anyone else's. That's just the way of it. It's a solo deal. Nature of the beast. You have a real thing for vampires. Yeah, I need all the help I can get talking about this stuff. But back to the original question. Wouldn't an enlightened Zen master believe in Zen? Wouldn't an enlightened Sufi believe in Islam? You're talking about vehicles and destinations. Once one has arrived at the destination, the vehicle is discarded, forgotten. If I take a train to Chicago, I get off the train and enjoy Chicago. I don't drag the train around behind me. It did its job. I don't need it anymore. Of course, if one is going to turn back and help others with their journeys, then he would rely on the vehicle he knows, which, in your case, many vehicles. The kitchen window faces north and provides a wide view of the clouds as they make their easterly trek. This cold front has brought with it an astounding range of cloud shapes so varied that simply by going outside and turning around, we can enjoy majestic and varied panoramas in all directions. Storms brewing in the west and raging to the south. Mountainous white cloud formations so massive and looming that there is an almost surreal imminence to them. From the kitchen window, of course, we can't see in all directions, but what we can see is stunning. Julie startles me by leaning in close and speaking into my collar. "What do you want?" I look at her, trying to gauge the intent of the question. Seeing my confusion, she holds her notes up for me to see. Right there, question 14. What does Jed want? It's still not clear to me what she means, but the answer is probably the same, no matter how the question is interpreted. I don't want anything. I don't want. Her eyes go wide. I knew you were going to say that. I've been thinking about it for days, and I just can't put it together. How can you not want anything? What does that even mean? What is life without desires, goals, dreams? Don't you have aspirations? Isn't there something you'd like to achieve or some quality you'd like to possess? It seems like life is all about expanding and attaining, moving toward the next thing, ambition, growth, conquest. You can't mean that you... I'm not even sure how to say it. You don't want anything? You have to want something? I'm amused by her perplexity. Well, I might want a cup of coffee or some new video game or something, but there's nothing in any larger sense that I want. World peace? She tries. The liberation of all sentient beings? Fame and fortune? Power? Prestige? Wealth? Adulation? Your own island? Six-pack abs? Compose a symphony? Dinner with the Buddha? There must be something. Something that drives you. Something you want. I answer through my laughter. Sorry to be so bland, but no, nothing. Well, maybe the abs. I don't have to wish for possessions because I have a pretty good idea of how the universe works, and my wishes are fulfilled practically before I know I wish them. World peace and the liberation of sentient beings would indicate a belief on my part that something was wrong or that something needs fixing. And I'm not capable of any such belief. I'm certainly not a bodhisattva or a satguru, as I understand those terms. The other things you mentioned are just, well, outer adornments. They would have no meaning to anyone in my situation. You say it that way. Anyone in your situation, because, to make it clear, that we're really not talking about me, but any awakened being. These things I'm saying aren't special facets of Jed McKenna. They'd be true of anyone who is awake. And when you say outer adornments, you're saying, what, that power and prestige? Power, prestige, wealth, adulation, six-pack, abs, sure, whatever defines us. However we describe ourselves, think of ourselves, project ourselves, every feature, trait, characteristic, feeling, belief, opinion, all of it, selfness. It's all just, like, worthless? Is that what you're saying? Like, a person is just a costume? A costume, yes. Worthless is redundant in a game without stakes. So the costume is the false self. She makes it a statement. Again, redundant, because there's no true self. But yes, the costume represents the fictional self, ego. We erect ego to compensate for the lack of direct self-knowledge. Lack of perception of true self is translated by the individual as non-existence of true self. In other words, because true self is unseen, it's assumed not to exist. Can't see it, so it must not be there. Well, can't see it because it's not there. There is no true self to perceive. There's only false self and no self. One looks for true self and finds nothing, as if one's true self was no truth at all. Which it kind of is. Isn't that what you're saying? Yes, and it's the dread of that nothingness that keeps one's attention outwardly fixed. I use the term dread to denote that we're talking about a vague, faceless quality. Not many people actually put a name to it. They seldom come right out and say that deep down inside they feel insubstantive or without basis. Those that do stand a good chance of being medicated or institutionalized. But what about when people explore their inner selves, make journeys of self-discovery? Aren't they going within to find the truth? They're just exploring the ego, making a study of the false self, which is a life quest as valid as any other. But you don't wake up by perfecting your dream character. You wake up by breaking free of it. There's no truth to the ego, so no degree of mastery over it results in anything true. Putting attention on the ego merely reinforces it. The tape recorder snaps off, so we pause while Julie puts in a fresh tape. When she's ready, I continue. This actually gets kind of interesting if you want to understand people better, understand what motivates them, why they do what they do. The deepest truth of any person is no person. One may insist otherwise with every thought and feeling, but that doesn't change the truth. It's not fear of death that drives humans. It's fear of non-being, oblivion. I know that I'm all over the road with this, and the apparent contradictions are piling up, but it's a fun topic to play with, and I have a pretty good sense that we're in the ballpark of what I should be saying to Julie at this point. For instance, shame. The underlying cause of all shame is the deep and unshakable suspicion that I am an imposter. I sense the absence of true self in myself, but not in others, so I naturally assume others to be real. Seeing the outer shells everyone else has so convincingly erected and not knowing them to be hollow, I necessarily feel singularly fraudulent and, of course, shameful. Oh, geez, I'm trying to follow this. So someone, say me, so I don't have the direct experience of my true nature, so I'm forced to create, project, maintain, constantly. Project an image of me. But I think I'm the only one doing it because everyone else looks real. Sure. How could it be otherwise? Everyone else seems genuine, while you have some degree of awareness of your own inauthenticity, ranging from maybe none at all on any conscious level to a degree that could cause a meltdown. She pauses for a moment, eyes downward, considering. So, none at all. Meaning some people are just totally oblivious, just live their lives totally unaware. You don't really need to ask me that. You can see it all around you. People completely in character, no inkling that things may be other than they seem, still shackled in Plato's cave. The degree to which one is unaware of one's fraudulent nature might be considered the degree to which one is in the grip of Maya, delusion, the dream state. It's very tempting to believe that one evolves over the course of who knows how many lifetimes, becoming progressively more and more awake from life to life. Increased awakeness would naturally translate into greater dissatisfaction with fraudulence, falseness, and delusion, and a corresponding desire to know what's real. Extend the line forward, and it results in a complete break with ego and an awakening into truth. Julie pronounces the word like a death sentence. One's true nature. Sure. And that's also why the process of waking up can look a lot like a massive breakdown. In fact, I suppose that's essentially what it is. A complete break from one has always assumed to be reality. That's why depression, for instance, might be hard to combat, because it can be a perfectly rational response to a highly irrational situation, namely life, especially when the depression revolves around futility or insignificance. After all, you can't be much more futile or insignificant than a character in a dream. The way to defeat rational depression is not to try at all costs to turn back from it or to cling to the illusion of meaning, but to plow right on through it and see what's on the other side. Rather than recoil from the horror of nothingness, plunge headlong into it. What's there to lose? But of course, the point of depression isn't to conquer it. What's the point of depression? I look at her, wondering what she's really asking, wondering why I'm really answering. The truth isn't always the best answer, but when in doubt, I tend to go with it. Same as the point of any other ride in the park. The point of the ride is the ride. That stops her. She pauses, thinking. Her agitation is becoming plainer now, closer to the surface. So no one even has a self? That's what you're saying, right? That there is there's no truth? Oh, everyone has an underlying truth. But yeah, no one knows it any more than your dream characters know they are products of the sleep state of the larger self. No one who's not enlightened, you mean? Yes, I confirm. That's the distinction. She's not comfortable hearing this. So unenlightened people don't know themselves? Don't know their own true natures? And so they have to create artificial selves because, she jumps in, because that's the only self they know. And that's the ego. That's the false self. Right. So when they talk about annihilating the ego, right, they're saying that if you destroy the false, then only the true remains. Jesus. So I'm constantly constructing a false self? Constantly. Yes, that's how you spend your energy, your life force. It all goes into projecting the illusion of you. You're constantly projecting an external representation of yourself that is always a work in progress, always shifting and evolving. Which everybody does? Interesting point. Yes and no. It's a matter of degree. When you think of truly selfless people, this is the level at which a difference exists. A selfless person has found definition in something other than self. Rather than projecting, they're fulfilling. They have relinquished their self-defining role to some outside agency. Motherhood might be a good example, or giving one's life to God, or dedicating oneself to a cause or a creative endeavor. They're still on stage, It's still a costume. Their life force is still spent animating their character. But they are stepping into a role rather than creating one. So, giving oneself over to a higher power, higher, lower, whatever, the giving over is the crucial factor. It doesn't matter if it's to God or country or the carving of a walking stick. A walking stick. Thoreau wrote a story about a guy who transcended self through absolute dedication to a single task, carving a walking stick. So, like Sonea? Yes, Sonea. You said yes and no. Right. A selfless person has dedicated, or abdicated, to put it another way, himself or herself to a single defining ideal. But the process is fundamentally the same, whether one selects a single ideal, or a dozen, or 100. All those things that define a person, career, community, family, and so forth, are all just predefined roles that one steps into, animates. In a very real sense, they're all acts of abdication. But who is abdicating? What is being abdicated? Those are the real questions. What is left when all context is dropped? What is left when you remove church, job, relationships, hobbies, and everything else? More layers? Nature? Nurture? Perinatal influences? Past life influences? Okay, but what's beyond those? That's the process, stripping away layer after layer, like an onion, until all that's left is, but an onion is only layers. So is ego, self, only layers. Remove all the layers, and no self is left. And no self is true self? There is no true self. But yeah, that's the general idea. Then who am I talking to? You'd do better to wonder what you're referring to when you say I, or who's referring to I, or who's wondering who's referring to I, and so on and so on. She's getting exasperated. I totally don't get it. Or you could use Ramana Maharishi's popular mantra, who am I? But that's a bit misleading, so I'll change it to, what is me? Oh, like that really clears things up. Or maybe you can use it as a koan, like, what is your original face before you were born? You're messing with me. It's nothing trickier than figuring out what's left when all the layers of delusion are pulled away. It's just about what's true. It couldn't be simpler. Literally. What was true about a mosquito that lived 10,000 years ago is just as true about the mosquito now. What's true about a spark that will exist for a thousandth of a second a million years from now and a million light years from here is as true here and now as it will ever be. It never was not true, and it never will be not true. And those truths, and my truth, and your truth, and the truth of Jesus, and Buddha, and Hitler, and Mother Teresa, and a dead fish floating in the Ganges, and all the ascended masters, and the Milky Way galaxy, and every single thought anyone ever thought, are all the same truth. It always was. And always will be. Time and space come and go, but what's true is true, and all the rest is but a dream. Ah. Silence. Possible irritation. Possible agitation. Time is required. We wander into the living room and, finding it empty, take seats on the couch. We sit quietly for a while until Julie decides to continue. So, for example, what would my false self be made up of? Same as anyone's. However you define yourself is how you create your false self. Your career, obviously, gives you a framework and structure for who you are and what you do and why. Family is a big one, or a A lot of big ones, as one fulfills different roles for different people. Mother, daughter, sister, wife, aunt, and so forth. Other relationships, community, nationality and racial identity, gender, of course, status as a financial entity, church membership, physical condition and appearance, education, politics, hobbies, beliefs, opinions, thoughts, feelings, everything. These are all the things that require your energy in order to remain viable aspects of yourself. If you stop putting your energy into cleaning the house, then you can no longer define yourself as a good housekeeper. What if I pay someone to keep my house clean? Money is energy once removed. It's an exchange medium for energy. And by energy you mean simply that if you wish to think of yourself as a caring, giving person, you'll have to care for something, give to something. If you want to be physically attractive, you have to do all the things necessary to project attractiveness in order to have it reflected back to you. Have my attractiveness reflected back to me? Have you ever seen your own face directly? Looked into your own eyes? Well, no, I guess not. Similarly, the false self cannot be perceived directly, but only by the reflection it casts in the eyes of others. Are we back to the vampires now? Why? Oh, because they don't cast a reflection. Boy, that analogy just keeps going and going. It's almost spooky. It is spooky. Okay, so if I want to think of myself as attractive, I need other people to see me as attractive? Sure. We spend our lives and our life force cultivating and grooming our appearance in the eyes of others. That's how we know that we exist. That's how we know who we are. That's where we find reassurance that we are real and not just hollow dream characters. That's how the illusion is constantly maintained. So, like, when they say perception creates reality, perception is reality. There is nothing else, just like in a dream. Well, then who's doing the perceiving, the dreaming? Who's the dreamer? Well, from my perspective, it's me. Well, from my perspective, it's me. Oh? Well, that didn't get us very far, did it? Huh? Infinity holds infinite infinities. Oh, God, you're making my head swim. Mine too. Let's take a break and try to relax. Chapter 35. In the Ward of Fevered Minds. Bed after bed, child after child. Some calm, some thrashing, some laughing, some wailing, calling for mommy, calling for God. One sits up, eyes open, asking. I go to him, sit, answer. He nods, falls back, gone again. I was once in a bed like them, fevered, deluded. Now I'm in a chair. I suppose it's better. A room full of loonies. I return to my crossword puzzle until the next one sits up, asks. Jed McKenna. Chapter 36. I don't eat human eyeballs. Die while you're alive and be absolutely dead. Then do whatever you want. It's all good. Bunan. I make coffee. We prepare a tray with cups and cream and sugar and some sweet stuff and carry it all back to the couch in the living room, which is positioned to provide an unobstructed view of the turbulent clouds through large west-facing windows. This conversation is more interesting to me than many because I'm clarifying it for myself as we go along. When the topic is enlightenment, I can speak with perfect authority of a true master, and my only real challenge is how to transmit thoughts and ideas more succinctly. But when the topic is the nature of delusion, the ego, false constructs, and human nature, I'm just a guy with a little experience, a lot of interest, and good seats. Yes, I've gone through the transformative process, and yes, I remember a good deal from my own before and during periods. But whereas enlightenment is exactly the same for anyone, anytime, any place, the journey to it is as unique and varied as there are people to make it. Of course, battling past the ego to get to the truth has been at the heart of countless spiritual teachings in countless countries for countless centuries. Ego death, as a means to no self, abiding non-dual awareness, is what this journey is all about. That's the reason behind the devotion, the prayer, the meditation, the teachings, the renunciation. Anyone headed for truth is going to get there over the ego's dead body or not at all. There's no shortcut or easy way, no going under or around. The only way past ego is through it. And the only way through it is with laser-like intent and a heart of stone. The caterpillar doesn't become a butterfly. It enters a death process that becomes the birth process of the butterfly. The appearance of transformation is an illusion. One thing doesn't become another thing. One thing ends, and another begins. And why do so few succeed in this greatest of all journeys? For the simple reason that success, within the context of the dream, is pointless, whereas failure, or at least struggle, is very much to the point. Chasing enlightenment holds as many lessons for the unawakened soul as any other pursuit in the dreamscape of ego-bound reality, as any other ride in the park. The supposed mega-bliss of spiritual awakening is a carrot dangling from a stick, no less than love or wealth or power. In other words, actual enlightenment is seldom the point of the quest for enlightenment. And why should it be? Success in realizing one's true nature is absolutely assured because, well, because it's one's true nature. The greatest wonder isn't that you'll make it back. It's that you made it away. Returning is the motion of the Tao. Struggling to achieve truth is, in its own way, as preposterous as struggling to achieve death. What's the point? Both will find you when it's time. Should we worry that if we fail to find death, death will fail to find us? Of course not. And neither death, nor taxes, nor gravity, nor tomorrow's sunrise is as certain as the fact that everyone will end up fully enlightened, regardless of the path they take. So if I have to be interested in something, this seems like a good choice, watching the homeward migration of souls. And if I have to have a job, this seems like a good one, standing on the distant shore, keeping a beacon fire burning, helping newcomers ashore, offering a welcome and pointing out some of the sights. Julie plops down on the couch next to me, and we sit and silently watch the sky unfold and refold. It looks like there's a mean storm coming in, but I know that it won't turn out that way. This cold front produces some spectacular sights, and also creates many illusions. What looks like a monstrous thunderhead now will likely turn out to be no more than a darkening and a sprinkle of rain before the next event takes shape and rolls in. I hunker down, put my feet up, and enjoy the show. Julie still seems slightly wired, as if a current was rippling just beneath her surface. It's a subtle thing, but she's clearly uncomfortable. She's bottled something up, and I wonder if I'll be around when it blows. When I continue speaking, I try to adopt a lighter tone. We're all afloat in a boundless sea. And the way we cope is by massing together in groups and pretending in unison that the situation is other than it is. We reinforce the illusion for each other. That's what a society really is. A little band of humanity huddled together against the specter of a pitch-black sea. Everyone is treading water to keep their heads above the surface, even though they have no reason to believe that the life they're preserving is better than the alternative they're avoiding. It's just that one is known and one is not. Fear of the unknown is what keeps everyone busily treading water. All fear is fear of the unknown. If someone in such a group of water treaders betrays the group lie by speaking the truth of their situation, that person is called a heretic, and society reserves its most awful punishments for heretics. If someone decides to stop struggling and just sink or float away, every possible effort is made to stop him, not for the benefit of the individual, but for the benefit of the group, to deny at all costs the truth of the situation. "Whistling past the graveyard," Julie intones, "rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic." I laugh. "Yes, but it's not just death that has everyone flustered. Anyone can create a scenario to deal with death. But what's beyond that scenario? Another scenario, and another. Eventually, you run out of turtles." "Huh? Turtles?" A student goes to his teacher and asks, "What does the world rest upon, master?" To which the teacher replies, "On the back of a giant turtle." The student, not to be so easily put off, asks, "And what does the turtle rest upon, O wise one?" To which the teacher replies, "Upon another turtle." The student is not ready to give up. "And what does that turtle rest on?" he asks. To which the master angrily replies, "Don't you get it? It's turtles all the way down." Julie laughs and nods her head. The truth of the situation is that eventually there's nothing. Infinity, eternity, the void, the abyss. Eventually, every water treader has to deal with the fact that it's just him, the infinite ocean and nothing in between. And that everything else is a lie. Basically, yes. The body is just a rental car, and this planet is just a motel. This is nobody's home, though some treat it like a permanent residence, as if the worst thing that can possibly happen is that you pick up and move on. How absurd, and yet how absolutely vital to the experience. Look at things in this light, and you'll see the countless ways in which society encourages the externalized self and mocks, discourages, and combats the very notion of turning inward. Alan Watts called it the taboo against knowing who you are. In order to break with one's false self, one would have to break with everything, Julie says. Family, friends. Her voice falters as she considers the ramifications. Everything. Everything you are, everything you know, everything. Really, everything. I decide I'd better back it off a notch. So the main point here is that I, as an enlightened person, have direct and abiding knowledge of self. You, as an unenlightened person, don't. You, therefore, have built an identity with which you, identify. You think of you as you. Now, maybe in the darkest hours of the night, in your heart of hearts, you know that it's all a facade and you bewail your falseness and yearn for truth or substance or a foundation or whatever. Bewail? It's a word, isn't it? How about bemoan? Bewail's okay. She relents. So, there it is. That's the fundamental difference between an enlightened person and an unenlightened one, having or not having direct knowledge of self, the latter being the breeding ground of ego. She's staring out the window. When she speaks, it's not intensely, but not casually either. So everyone's just treading water, not really doing anything, not really going anywhere, because it's a boundless sea, right? Endless? Where's there to go? You go forever and ever, and you're still nowhere. Everyone's just pretending. It's all just... I'm aware that she's not really speaking to me now. She's working things out for herself, doing the math, seeing what's always been right in front of her. And it takes, like, every ounce of energy just to stay afloat and stay with the group. I can see that. All anybody's really doing is pretending. Everything I've ever done, my whole life. I decide to give her something specific to shine on. The Tao says that the sage sees people as straw dogs, and that's what it means. All exterior, no interior. Empty costumes populating the stage like zombies. All appearance, no substance. Yes, the unenlightened look like zombies to the enlightened, like fictional characters animated by mysterious forces. No one home. If a person were born enlightened, rather than going from unenlightened to enlightened and having the experience of being made of straw, I think he'd find this a damn spooky place. Busy, populated, yet strangely uninhabited. Julie is still and silent. Her eyes are wide and unblinking, staring off into nothing. When she does speak, it's with a distant quality, as if she's merely thinking aloud. You know, I've done a lot of research since we've started this interview. Bookstores, the library, magazine stands, the internet. I even went back to the co-op and bought a copy of that Enlightenment magazine you were looking at.
Sorry to hear that, I say.
Why? She nearly shouts, very present now, arms tightly crossed, holding herself together, addressing me very directly. Because none of that stuff is what you're talking about, is it? They call it enlightenment, but it's something else, isn't it? She leaps up and begins pacing. She's processing, unraveling, coming undone. Fun to watch. A controlled breakdown, or maybe not so controlled, we've yet to see. This is what I saw in her, of course, the chaotic energy she was trying to keep suppressed. Jesus! When they told me I was going to Iowa to do a piece on a spiritual master, I thought it was a euphemism for, you're fired! Iowa, for Christ's sakes! She stops pacing and looks to me to see if I appreciate the improbability of it. She continues pacing. I've been thinking about this a lot. I haven't been getting much sleep lately. She laughs without mirth. This is really confusing me. I mean, I think of myself as someone who is on the spiritual path. I mean, I'm a spiritual person. I do all the spiritual stuff. I do yoga, and I meditate, and I'm a vegetarian, and I'm compassionate. I catch spiders and put them outside instead of killing them. I read all the books. I attend all the lectures. I have pictures of mandalas and saints on my walls, and I send money to support a little girl in Paraguay. Or maybe it's Uruguay, although I'm not sure there really is a little girl, if you want to know the truth. And if I really think about it all, this, I think I'm doing it all because I want to be a good person. And I want to be spiritual and loving and open and compassionate, but also because I'm on the path, and I've always assumed that the path leads to enlightenment and freedom from bondage and all that, and breathe. She breathes. And it's all bullshit, isn't it? She stops pacing and thinks about it for a few moments before continuing. So I go out this week, and I start reading all the current bestsellers on enlightenment to prepare for our next interview. And as I'm reading all these supposedly spiritually enlightened people, and it's like a light went on in my brain. It just clicked. I wait to find out what her epiphany was, although I pretty much already know. I don't mean to detract or minimize it in any way. I really have a thing for epiphanies. They're my raison d'être, so to speak. You said it yourself, she continues. Of course you could murder me. You could smoke crack and shoot Bambi and eat human eyeballs and draw mustaches on all the saints if you wanted, couldn't you? Because it wouldn't make any difference. You're enlightened. You're there. You're it. You don't have to act enlightened. I know you're enlightened. I'm not an idiot. I know what I'm looking at. But how come I've never seen it before? I've been into all this spiritual shit for 15 years. I've done darshan and satsang with all the big names. Hell, I've interviewed most of them. What does that make them? What does that make me? It's like a sick joke. It's like you say, I'm just spending my whole life treading water because that's what everyone says to do, and I never questioned it. But now I am questioning it, and I think that if I keep going this way, I'll end up sitting on my deathbed no better off than if I'd stomped the living shit out of every spider I ever saw. I make no response. This is an important time to let her flow with the whole thing. She is visibly processing herself into a new level of awareness, and the only way I can help is by not interrupting. This is it, the first step. It's not the realization of what is, but of what's not. It's the grand disillusionment. Enlightenment is still a ways off, but the process is now beginning, has now begun. In a few years, I'll ask her how the enlightenment thing is working out, and she'll say, "Real good, thanks, really getting a kick out of it. You?" But that's still a ways down the road. Enlightened doesn't even seem like the real word. I look at you, and it's like you're real, fully realized. I don't know. You're not... I don't know. You're awake, and I've never seen an awake person before. And what are those other guys? It's not even similar. They're just like bliss bunnies and love drunks getting high on the divine or kundalini energy or on doing the guru thing. They're all about consciousness. But it's not really a consciousness thing, is it? Hell, I've experienced unity consciousness, and it was totally mind-blowing and all that, and I guess I always thought that that was the destination of the spiritual path, but... It's like when someone called religion the opiate of the masses. That's all this spiritual stuff is, but it's like a higher dosage or something. It's like a vast conspiracy all designed to keep people where they are by convincing them that they're going somewhere when they're just sitting there, like you say, floating, treading water, pretending. And no one knows it's a conspiracy, do they? I mean... I'm a New Age journalist. I've been going along with it all my adult life, and I never knew. I never intended to defraud anyone. I thought I was running separate from the herd. What a joke. I've been right alongside of it every minute. I'm amused that she calls the entire dualistic universe, Maya's Palace of Delusion, a vast conspiracy. Can I just say something for the record? I ask. Sure, she says. I don't eat human eyeballs or shoot Disney characters. I'm a nice guy. I'd hate to see that in print. She laughs a bit hysterically. Actually, I don't know if I can write the article now. It was just supposed to be a simple piece on, you know, a spiritually elevated guy in his little ashram in America's heartland. What is it now? Some expose that's supposed to bust the New Age wide open, tear down the world's great religions, awaken a narcotized humanity? No way. That's the end of that. But now I don't even want to be a writer anymore. Not in the way I have been. I don't know what I want to be. The whole spirituality thing is just like the most pointless merry-go-round. God! I can't stop thinking about this. My mind has been trying to get a handle on all this since I saw you on Saturday. I'm only really beginning to understand it all myself, and I can't believe anyone can even think about anything else. I keep thinking, this is it. This is the only game in town, the only dance there is. What else could possibly matter? I look at other people going about their normal lives, and I want to scream, to shake them and wake them up. How can anyone watch a movie or go to work or eat a sandwich with this huge, freaking thing staring them right in the face? I mean, am I going insane? I know I'm not, but am I? Is this normal? Really, you can tell me. Am I being like the most total whack job? She has stopped pacing and is glaring at me. Me now? I ask. Yes, she says, laughing edgily. First, you're the only one who ever thought there would be an article.
I don't understand why Sonea does anything she does, but I know that she doesn't send me off to meet journalists so they can write about me.
Second, no, it's not normal. It's a whole lot different than normal. You're being born. What you're doing now is the start of a much larger process. I can advise you to whatever degree you wish.
But here's the key to minimizing the pain. Don't resist.
It's like you're going to stop treading water and sink away from the group and let yourself drown. You will resist, of course. It's natural. But try to let things take their course and trust in something higher. God, Krishna, Elvis, whatever. I went through the exact same thing, and I've seen others in the same place. It's not unusual, and you probably won't go nuts. That's the good news. Oh, damn. I hate the sound of that. That was the good news? What the hell's the bad news? It's not bad, really, but it's definitely transformative. What's happening to you is like a death-rebirth process. This is just the beginning. You can't go back. You can't stop. What you were before this started, who you were, is basically behind you. This isn't completely rare. Life is full of transitions like this. A move or a new job might be a small one. Becoming a vampire would be a relatively big one. She's looking pretty frayed by all this. How bad? She asks. It's not that it's bad. Well, yeah, it is. It rewrites everything. You don't really know what I mean by everything yet, but you're starting to. Your life has just entered a period of revolution, and I think you can probably expect not to be really settled again for quite some time. Her intensity fills the room. I've seen people require hospitalization at this stage. She paces back and forth, muscles taut, eyes bright. This may be the most awake she's ever been, so far. Am I turning into, you know, a vampire? Lao Tzu said that what the caterpillar calls the end of the rest of the world calls a butterfly. She's looking at me hopefully. Say that again? What the caterpillar calls the end of the rest of the world calls a butterfly. She nods, thinking as hard as she can. She's in a mild state of shock brought on by the emotional toll of this whole thing building up in her over several days, and further exacerbated by poor diet and lack of sleep. On top of all that, there's the total disruption of normalcy, the thrill of self-discovery, and the fear of entering unknown waters. Quite a mix. I know one person who had to be handcuffed by police, strapped face down on a stretcher, and transported by ambulance to a facility for a psychological observation at this approximate stage of the transformation. It can be a dicey time. Zen guys, among others, talk about this part. But for the most part, a severe psychological break is not a big selling point for a spiritual teaching. People want all the goodies, the perfect knowledge and the freedom from suffering and all that, but no one wants to pay for it. This is the price, where Julie is now, or the beginning of it anyway. The simple fact is that it's a bloody mess. And the love and bliss crowd doesn't sign up for that. They want the enlightenment that doesn't include relinquishing one's place among fellow water treaders. They don't want to stop treading, don't want to slip alone into the blackness. They want the other enlightenment, the one where they can stay with the group and keep their carefully constructed personalities and just be happy. Preferably, really, really, really happy. I like happiness as much as the next guy, but it's not happiness that sends one in search of truth. It's rabid, feverish, clawing madness to stop being a lie, regardless of the price, come heaven or hell. This isn't about higher consciousness or self-discovery or heaven on earth. This is about blood-caked swords and Buddha's rotting head and self-immolation. And anyone who says otherwise is selling something they don't have. I never doubted that Julie's conscious intent in speaking to me was to interview me for an article. But I certainly never thought for an instant that Sonea's intent had anything to do with an interview. With Sonea, though, you don't ask. You just wait for unfolding. Julie sits next to me, staring blankly out the window and trembling slightly. Sonea enters, takes her by the hand, and gently leads her out. She'll take Julie to one of the bedrooms, make her some tea, and let her rest. Of course, for Julie, nothing's over. It's a long way from over. Her entire life has culminated in this beginning. She has just left solid footing forever. I unclip the mic and set the recorder aside. 20 minutes later, Sonea returns and sits next to me on the couch where Julie had been. "She'll sleep," she says. Sonea scrunches down into a more relaxed position and puts her feet up on the coffee table next to mine, and we sit silently, tranquil, content, happy just to watch the shifting sky and idly wonder what's coming next, but not worried, knowing, each in our own way, that whatever's coming is going to be good. But hey, that's a no-brainer. It's all good. Do you see, O my brothers and sisters? It is not chaos or death. It is form, union, plan. It is eternal life. It is happiness. Walt Whitman. Chapter 37. Why not? Spiritual enlightenment sits next to an empty milk carton on an orange lunch tray in a grade school cafeteria. It's lying in the grass in a ditch beside a rusting hubcap. It's on the button holding closed the left cuff of a somewhat important man's shirt. Enlightenment can be found next to the elevator on the fourth level of an airport parking garage. You can ask your dog for it, but he may not give it to you. Look for it next to the pen in the pocket of the checkout girl's red vest, but only on Wednesdays. Enlightenment is in the trunk behind the jack. You can hear it in the squeak of a hinge at the local library. It's in the breeze blowing unheard through an unseen tree. It's in the space after the exhale and before the inhale. You can find enlightenment in church, in that scratch on the back of the pew in front of you. You can find it in the desert, just before the wind picks up again. Enlightenment is nothing. Delusion is the greatest wonder. Enlightenment was in your coffee cup before you poured in the coffee. Now, it's in your coffee cup. 2.2 billion years before your coffee cup was created, enlightenment was in your coffee cup. an hour and 15 minutes after time swallows the universe, enlightenment will be in your coffee cup. You've always known where it is because it's exactly where you left it. How can you not return to a place you never left? You are dreaming that you are unenlightened. You are dreaming that you are awake. The question is, why? The answer is, why not? Jed McKenna. Epilogue. Spiritual enlightenment is the damnedest thing. It is literally self-defeating. It is a battle we wage upon ourselves. Truth is a uniquely challenging pursuit because the very thing that wants it is the only thing in the way of it. It's a battle we will kill to lose and must die to win. The great enemy is the very self that wages the war. So how can there be victory? When self is destroyed, who wins? Why would anyone, knowing the price of victory, undertake so senseless a battle? Arjuna wouldn't. He weighed the cost against the gains and set down his weapon rather than launch such a war. The Bhagavad Gita is the story about why he picked his weapon back up. It is summed up in these two lines. The unreal has no being. The real never ceases to be. If I were to reduce this book and my teachings to their essence, I would say it all comes down to nothing more than this. Think for yourself and figure out what's true. That's it. Ask yourself what's true until you know. Everything else in this book, everything else I have to say on the subject, turns on that center. That's the note I'd like to end on. It's your show. It's your universe. There's no one else here, just you. And nothing is being withheld from you. You are completely on your own. Everything is available for direct knowing. No one else has anything you need. No one else can lead you, pull you, push you, or carry you. No one else is necessary to your success. It cannot be simpler. You are asleep, and you can wake up. If you understand that, you'll understand that it's the best news you could possibly receive. Behold, the way is open unto thee. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. This book is more about getting to that first step than the rest of the journey. Once you've begun, there's no stopping or turning back. But as we say in the skydiving game, you have to watch out for that first step. It's a doozy. I'll leave you with one final glimpse behind the veil. Row, row, row your boat, gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 merrily. Life is but a dream. You have just finished listening to Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing, by Jed McKenna. Copyright 2002, Wise Fool Press. Produced by Vincent Media Group at the Marvelous Marconi Studio. This book and Jed McKenna's next book, Spiritually Incorrect Enlightenment, are available in print, electronic, and audio editions from the Wise Fool Press website at www.wisefoolpress.com. Please watch our website for new publications and products. Thank you for listening. End of Disc 8.